conference. Please enter the conference ID, followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted. For help with guest options, press star 0. You will now be connected with the conference.
Tell it was gone, so I deleted that stuff to be on the safe side, because if it isn't gone, I wouldn't have a clue how to operate it. I did offer the use of my GoToMeeting, but there was some reason why that wasn't a suitable solution. I can't remember what the reason was.
Peter, I'm checking in.
Hi, Peter. How are you?
Hello, Matthew. Hello, Mike.
Hi, Peter. Oh, well, Peter will know the answer. Why is GoToMeeting not a suitable environment for doing these things in?
I don't know. Was there a decision?
No.
I don't. Mm. I mean, we had on occasions asked Mike for the use of his GoToMeeting.
Mm.
Right.
We did before.
Right.
In ontology summits.
It might be to do with numbers. Might be something you would need to check out.
Maybe it's the cost.
The cost is, I'm actually paying for my own GoToMeeting account now, separate from the one the EDM Council pays for. Mm-hmm. And it allows up to 100 people.
Wow, fantastic.
So it used to be 25. Yeah, so maybe that was the reason before, was the 25 limit, which would have been inappropriate. Good. So what I'll do that.
So how much does that cost you?
It's something like 50 quid a month or something. I can't remember now. But.
And that's independent of how much you use it?
Exactly, yes.
Oh, right,
and
okay.
Anytime I'm on one of these calls, I'm not using it for anything else because I don't share it with anyone else. So it's essentially free.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Because, I mean, it took a little bit before we got IAOA to pick up the bill for this conference bridge, which is like $70 a month.
Yeah.
100 people.
Oh, does this only cover 100 people as well?
Yes.
Right. Interesting. Yeah, and unfortunately, as I say to Matthew, my memory is a bit leaky about which of these things were where. I had to read about 7 of the Board of Trustees meetings before I knew what existed and what didn't. And I shall write it all up before I forget and before anybody else needs to figure out the same thing. But it sounds like I might as well add the GoToMeeting support into there as well for future sessions.
Yeah,
replace Skype.
Right. If anything, I think that the reason why GoToMeeting may not be as effective is that this conference bridge supports both voice over IP calls over Skype as well as dial-ins. A lot of the government people can't use VoIP during their work time. And they have phones. I mean, if you provide a phone number for them to dial in, they could.
Mm. That's an interesting point, because GoToMeeting actually does both, but I wasn't thinking
of
GoToMeeting.
But they do now. I mean, they didn't used to.
But I wasn't thinking of GoToMeeting as a replacement for the dial-in, but merely as a replacement for the VNC screen sharing.
Oh, definitely. I mean, since we haven't had VNC since I pulled out, I think that definitely would be good. Oh, before you start, I mean, you need to start fairly soon. Have you made arrangements to get this recorded?
No, we were just talking about that. I know Ken often informally records things, but
I mean, he formally does.
As a result, I have absolutely no idea how to formally record it.
Right. It's not just recording; it's quite a bit of work afterwards.
I know. Yeah, you have to write file format and all of that.
Right.
And I'm literally.
Yeah.
Mm, editing. Eek. Yeah, no, I literally have no idea what to do about that. Somebody did mail and ask if this was being recorded.
Right, so you have no idea whether he's going to come in today.
I should have mailed him just to make sure, but...
Now that I'm online, I can get it recorded, but I probably wouldn't have time to do the post-processing. I can get you guys the raw MP3 recording.
Oh, that would be fantastic. If you do that and just pop it in the directory, and then I'll point Ken at that.
Mm-hmm.
I know what to do with it. Fantastic. Thank you.
We need to spread the skill set around a bit.
Right. I took great time to train somebody up, and she wasn't quite engaged. I mean, I think she even offered the last ontology summit, but nobody tried to engage her. What's her name again? Let me try to recall the name. I'll get you there in a moment. Yeah, move on with your other stuff. Why find the name?
Right. Yeah, so I think we'll take up those things at the next planning meeting. Right, so it's half past. My instinct is to give it a couple of minutes for other people to arrive. Also, it is very quiet, but last time I decided it was very quiet and didn't meet everybody, it got noisier later, so I think we'll stick to the usual tradition and meet everybody when we start, and then people can unmute during question time using the instructions I've posted a little way up the chat there. Star 7 to mute and star 6 to... star 7 to unmute and star 6 to remute again afterwards, so that's it.
I've got the name now. I mean, if maybe Mike Matthew can write it down. It's Christy Kapp, K-A-P-P. And if you go to the Ontology Summit 2014 symposium, she actually made the whole, she and I put together a whole talk on sort of the program, project management on Ontology Summit and the processes and so on.
Ah.
And it was the end of the first day program. But Ontology Summit 2014, Christy Kapp.
Thanks. Okay. So welcome, everyone. I see a couple of people just arriving. If you can change your name from anonymous to a camel case version of your name so that we know who everybody is, that would be fantastic. We'll give people a minute or so to settle down, and then we will formally start the session, and I will introduce Dr. West. Can you all hear me okay?
Yes.
Very good. Thanks. Lovely. You're all loud and clear as well. Okay, I'll wait for one more anonymous person to their name, and then I think we may as well get started. Okay, so I'm going to mute everyone. When we come to question time, if you can use the hand icon to raise your hand, that little thing near the bottom right of the screen next to the little Z's, and then use it again to untoggle it when you're done, and you will need to press star 7 on your phone's in order to speak, and then just make sure that's worked. Make sure you haven't also muted locally and stuff like that. So I'm going to mute everyone at this stage. And Matthew, I guess you're going to need to press star 7 now to...
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can, loud and clear.
Good.
It's all working. Fantastic. Okay, so welcome everyone, and thank you, Peter, for agreeing to do the recording. This session will now be recorded, just so that everybody is aware. Welcome back to the Ontolog Forum. We have the first of a fairly short, informal series of invited speakers. So instead of our usual thing of having two or three speakers, we will have one speaker and then plenty of time for questions and discussion. We meet every second week at this time. So there's one today, one in 2 weeks' time. And the 1 week, 2 weeks after that will actually be a continuation of the ontology-based standards mini-series to be confirmed. But here we are. We're back. We're here every second week. And... This week, I would like to introduce Dr. Matthew West, who will be presenting on a presentation called From Third Normal Form to a Web-Enabled World. So Matthew will be presenting to us on changes in the way data has been structured, to meet changing needs of databases over the years, and look at the implications for that looking forward to web-enabled data. I think Matthew will make far more sense of that than I am trying to describe it. So without further ado, it gives me great pleasure to hand you over to Matthew West.
Hello. Yes, I'm Matthew West, and we're going to be talking about, there's going to be some history and some futurology this evening, as I talk about how data has been structured in the past, how that's changed over time, and some of the changes I see that we're going to need to make as we move into a web-enabled world. I'm hoping you've all got the presentations that you've downloaded from the conference page. Is the conference page in the chat, Mike? The link to the if they're on the soap pub, then you've probably got that from the conference page anyway. So I'll tell you when I'm moving on from one slide to another. So I'm moving on to the second slide now from the title page. And that's just a little bit about me. I spent lots of time working for Shell. I'm actually a chemical engineer originally, but I fairly quickly moved into data management and data modeling and standards development for industrial data before I retired from Shell. And I've been doing various bits of consultancy since then. And of course, I've written a book. But that's a bit about me for those that don't know. Then on to slide 3, which is kind of the starting point. Data is normally going to be useful when it's used in information systems to supply the information that people need to make decisions in the running of their businesses, whatever sort of business that might be. And there are various things that you need to do. To manage information, you need to be able to meet the following requirements. These are things that you need to be able to do. Know what information exists and what it's about. Extract portions of the information suitable for a particular purpose. Exchange data between organizations and systems. Integrate information from different sources. Resolving the differences and the inconsistencies that there are, and share the same data between applications and users with different views, and manage the data, including its history, for life. And it's not unusual for some or all of these requirements to be difficult or expensive to meet, not least because a lot of the systems that most businesses use
Matthew, your sound has suddenly gone extremely quiet.
Sorry, is that any better?
There we are, thanks.
Okay. Because the systems were developed independently, there's no reason why they should be compatible with each other. Therefore, linking them up is quite difficult. And you usually need an integration model or something like that in order to be able to bring the information together so that it, from different places, so that it can be shared. And I noticed when I was working for Shell that this was causing a lot of problems. And so we looked at what were the desiderata for data models that were enabling you to integrate and share data amongst applications, which is something that you need to do pretty much all the time today. So, well, obviously you must be able to meet the data requirement. You must be able to store the data that's needed to support the decisions that are being made. The data model needs to be clear and unambiguous and not just to the authors of the data model. It's surprising how obscure many data models are. And, of course, even that's not enough because even if the definition of the data model is clear, it still requires that the users actually use it as it was intended, and that quite often doesn't happen as well. Data model needs to be stable in the face of changing data requirements. Now, what I mean by stable is that you, when you get a new data requirement that the existing model doesn't meet, you don't have to change the existing data model, you only have to add to it. Because if you have to change the data model, it means you have to restructure all the data, and that probably means you need to reprogram a lot of your applications as well. So stability is actually very important. And indeed, it's often the case that the stability is so important that if you can't meet the data requirements without changing the data structure, then you just don't meet the data requirements, unless it can only be done by adding. You just give up at that point. Be flexible in the face of changing business practices. And that's just the other side of the stability. You need to be able to support changing business practices with the data that you have, so support different views on the data. Be reusable by others, so the fact that you created a data model in one environment with one set of constraints that happen to apply in that situation, you need to be careful not to impose those constraints on the data structure, because if you do, you'll prevent other people who don't have those particular constraints from using it. Consistent with other models covering the same scope, that really means that you need to be able to map data from other data models, the applications that you're supporting, into it, and be able to reconcile conflicts between other data models, which again is the other side of the consistency. Of course, it's also desirable that you should be able to develop data models like this quickly. And I spent quite a bit of time working at that, but this isn't what was going on. If you look at what was going on in data modeling historically, you find that the approach that was taken was one of looking at normalization of data. So here's a single table with a record, just one record from that table, which is just some personnel data about a person, and we pick it up that there's a date that the person is Jack. They have a date of birth, which was in 1985. When they were born, they were single, not surprisingly, and they had a weight of about 4 kilograms and a height of about 0.45 meters. Now, this is a data model that is in third normal form, and in fact necessarily fourth and fifth normal form. Now, normalization is a series of rules that looks at things like duplication of data, and is about eliminating that. So a third normal form data model will have no duplicated data in it. Fourth and fifth are to do with really misusing relationships. So if you're in third normal form, you're usually also in fifth normal form, unless you've done something silly. So here we have, therefore, a data model which, although it's very simple, is nonetheless in fifth normal form, but it's a current state data model. So when we move on to look at the record, the same record in 1995, we see that the items in red have been changed. He's still single. He was still born in on the 15th of March 1985, and his name is still Jack. But his weight is now 30 kilograms, and his height is 1.3 meters. And then we move on again, and the record has been updated, and Jack is now married. He weighs 65 kilograms, and his height is 1.85 meters. Now, these are all the same record. So, of course, you've lost all the history when you updated the record. And this was reasonably typical of data models, certainly in the 80s and 90s. And actually, you see something not unlike this in what I would call naive ontologies even today, when you look at the equivalent ontologies to these data models. Now, if you want to manage change over time, the simplest thing to do would seem to be just to add a date for when the change happened. So now we have three records about Jack in the same database. Sorry, I'm on slide six. Thank you, Alex and Mike. We've got the first record is for when he was born. The second record was for when he was weighed and his height measured for the second time. And the third record is at some later date. And there might have been other records in between. And together this is enough to identify him. But we now have repeating groups. So we can see that the name Jack and the date of birth are repeated, as is his status being single in a couple of the cases as well. So this is what we mean by duplication. And the issue here is, in database parlance or relational parlance, you talk about update anomalies. So there isn't one place where you would have to, if it turned out that he had always been married, or that, that there would be more than one place that you had to update it, or in particular if his date of birth turned out to be wrong and had been incorrectly entered, then there are at least three places where you have to update that, not just one. And that's, so that's what's meant by there being repeating groups, and the duplication that arises from that. So this is only in, at least less than third normal form, probably only first normal form. And that's the consequence of just adding the date. It enabled us to hold the history, but we've lost the normalization. So now if we move on to slide seven, you need to renormalize. Now, the previous table would have just been one box, and you can see that we've moved to multiple boxes here. The thick lines, by the way, are subtype supertype relationships. The thin lines are just relationships. So we now have five boxes rather than one, but that does enable us to hold to have normalized it. And in fact, it was about 10 years ago that some people did some work that concluded that a model like this would, there's a new level of normalization which they called sixth normal form, which was about the data model handling change over time, as well as the other requirements for third, fourth, and fifth normal form. Now, this is going to be a good deal more stable, of course, than the previous model. If is in moving from a model that doesn't deal with history to one that does deal with history, you can see that it's a big change. So that original model was very unstable. So it's one that I would have always said, that's not a good model because it's not going to last a relatively simple change in requirements. I don't think sixth normal form is the same as bitemporality, but maybe we could discuss just what you mean by bitemporality a bit later. So that's the first stage, but that's not all that you need to do as you're moving into systems that are used by multiple people, different parts of an organization, and even different organizations. We need to add some metadata, and in particular, something like provenance. So now on slide eight, here's an example of actually the top entity in ISO 15926, which is called Thing. And you'll see that the lozenges on the right-hand side give you information like when the record was created. So that's not when the thing was created, that's when the record about the thing was created. Who created the record? When was the record created? When was it logically deleted? And why was it deleted? Now, those last two were there because we recognized that errors might come into the data. Someone might put the wrong data in by accident, or even on purpose, I suppose. And so you might want to logically delete it, but it would be dangerous to physically delete it because it might be in a relationship, it might already have been used, in which case you would it would be dangerous or impossible even to delete it without losing data integrity. So you would logically delete something and explain why. It was an error or whatever it was. Now, Something to note here is, if we move on to slide 9, that situation works quite well when you're in a controlled environment. And ISO 15926 was, although it's designed to be able to be used on the web, it's still within a closed environment where if you make updates to a record, that result would be pushed to those who were using that record, and you would know who had used it. But that's not the case necessarily when you have a data bus based system where you need to ask for the data. So in a data bus based system, it adds complexity if you have to make changes to records. And on the web, it becomes almost impossible because you don't even know who's going to be using the data necessarily if you publish data on the web. So you have absolutely no control over it. So if you imagine that you now make some changes to the data, the only way that a user of that data can even find out that you made a change is to download all the data again and compare it to what they had downloaded previously and see what the differences are. And that's really quite a heavy bit of processing. So the next step, I think, and I've not seen this done yet, but I think this is part of the futurology, if you like. The next step is records that never change, or that you never need to change, certainly, so that data is only ever added. Well, we can look at what that might look like if we go back to our ISO 15926 data model. We can see that that the last two relationships here were optional. It didn't have to be but you can't do that if it's going to be. I'm on slide 10. You can't do that if it's going to be unchanging. So we actually have to change the model so that we make it so that it can be the base record doesn't change. So again, moving on to slide 11, you can see that the logical deletion of record with the deletion time and the Y deleted is separated out. So you don't have an optional attribute on the entity that gets updated. You have a new record that is created, which is the logical deletion of record. And that tells you something about a very simple rule is that all your relationships must be mandatory. You can have no optional relationships in your data model. That's not enough because you can have relationships that are mandatory but which change over time. So you have to have dealt with the change over time things as well. That at least is a minimum that you can say for what your data model will look like. So moving on to slide 12, triple stores and beyond. Well, arguably it's a problem with triple stores that they break your data into tiny bits, where what you wanted was something like the record we started with. Because really you would be wanting to gather all the information about Jack into one place, one collection of data. And when you have it as a triple store, it becomes quite difficult to do that. And the solution that triple stores have for this is the named graph. You can use it for many purposes, not just collecting together what would otherwise have been in a traditional record, but you can do it for giving a collection of data some metadata, for instance. So there are all sorts of things that it can be used for. But nominally, it makes the record that you're talking just one of the objects in a triple. And one of the things that a lot of the people that have developed triple stores have done is actually the stores are really quad stores. And these are acknowledged by the W3C, but there is no definition of what the fourth element is for. So there's not a particular way that you can assume that it's going to be used. So it's up to the implementers what you do with that. And some implementers of quad stores are likely to have used the fourth element to support the name graph directly, so that you know you can actually say this element is part of this named graph, so that you have the triple and the named graph, a named graph that it's a part of, as the fourth element. But that's not a requirement. There's nothing that says that that's how you have to use that. And in ISO 15926, we found named graphs useful for what we called the object information models. And this is particularly this collecting the data back together that was about a particular thing. And you're still left now with what to do about the data about the record rather than the data about the object the record represents. And I actually wonder if we might one day see quint stores coming along where there's actually a separate identifier, one where you differentiate between identifiers that are representing, that are surrogates for the objects that are represented, and identifiers of the record itself, so that you can distinguish when you're talking about the record and when you're talking about the object, an object that's represented by a record in a record. So moving on to 13, and I'll throw it open to questions.
Thanks, Letty. Sorry, I was writing there. Fantastic. Any questions? Yes, we have two questions in the queue. So, Steve Ray, you're up first. Star 7 to unmute. Hi, Steve. We're not hearing you yet, Steve. Star 7? Steve Ray, you're up next in the queue, but we're not hearing you yet. You need to unmute locally and also... Oh, right, go ahead, sound problems. Okay, thanks, Steve. We'll wait while he's sorted that out. Todd Schneider, you're up next. I hope this doesn't mean there's some global problem in the sound. Todd, Star 7, unmute locally as well.
Have you got a way to unmute everyone?
I think there must be one, but it didn't announce it on the way in, so I'm going to have to go into the menu system. This may take me a moment or two, so do bear with me. Right.
Hello?
Yes, we've got everyone now, I think.
Ah, you got Steve Ray, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
You're all on
great.
Now.
Okay, well, I was just going to ask Matthew, so what's the bottom line? What do you recommend for someone? Do you think people should be trying to use some convention of triples with, you know, making it look like a fifth normal form or what?
Well, triples require you to break your data into small pieces anyway, and when you move into fifth normal form, you actually are very likely to have something which is relatively triple friendly. Well, sixth normal form or seventh normal form even. It's not as much of an issue as it would be. And the fact that you have some, as it might be if you were using a relational database, for instance, because triples
are... design guidance. What is your recommendation for someone building a new model?
I would... read my book is the obvious answer, isn't it? I would certainly look at very high levels of normalization. I think if you don't do that, and taking an ontological approach to it, so that you build change over time into it, you build how you're going to handle metadata into it, and you build it so that you only ever add data. Your data model is such that you never need to change a record. Those are the recommendations that I'm really making here.
Okay.
The way that I model things is ready for that. So indeed, reading my book would give you one way of doing that, but it's not the only way. I use a four-dimensionalist approach to data modeling, but it's fairly well known that there are alternatives to that.
Thanks. Todd, you're up next.
Hi. Are you receiving me?
We are.
Excellent. Well, thank you, Matthew. That was a very nice presentation. Given my, somebody say, I'm unencumbered by a great or extensive knowledge of relational databases, so anything I can learn about them is usually very helpful. And there's 2 points I want. Well, I have one question, 1 point. First of all, on your slide number 4, you have several items there that are listed that would make wonderful sales points for the use of semantic technologies. And I thank you for being so concise with them. Myself being very poor about trying to always clearly and consistently identify what the values of semantic technologies are. But my question regarding the subject of the talk, and I just posted it, Mike, what does normalization mean for ontology development, if anything?
Yeah, well, I think it's more useful than you might imagine.
Keep in mind, Matthew, I'm really ignorant of the notion of normalization in the context of relational databases.
Yeah, well, in ontologies, you have facts, and you have you still have instances and classes, which typically you have both of those in your ontology. So it's not so different from a database, really. Indeed, if you're developing an OWL ontology, an OWL-DL ontology, it really is data and a database, where there is just less distinction between which bits of data and which bits of database. There's not a lot of difference.
Well, could you frame a response to my question in the context of you have a theory, whether it's in OWL, DL, whether it's in first order logic, common logic, whatever, and the process of normalization? How does normalization reflect in changes to the theory that you create?
Well, it comes back to this idea of looking for data duplication. Do you have the same instances or elements in instances that are occurring multiple times in the way that you've done it? Are you dealing with change over time or not? Is your ontology a current state ontology? And can you deal with, and moving on to the web-enabled world where you're wanting people to read, do you only ever have to add to your ontology? Do you ever have to change it? Is it designed in such a way that... Because the big difference is, if you only ever have to add data, is that someone who is using your data or your ontology only has to read what was added to the store since they last picked up data. And then that's all they need to do. They don't need to compare the current version with the previous one they had to see what the changes are. They can just pick up the last chunk of data since they were last read it. And that hugely simplifies the processing that you have to do.
Okay, well, it sounds like what you've just said is that the most significant difference to the actual ontology development would be issues involving time, temporal aspects, and or the support of history or auditing.
It's all about change, one way or another. It's all about change. And if you have something that is, you know, fixed in aspect, it doesn't matter. That's it. It's not going to change, so it doesn't matter. But that almost certainly means there are no instances of it that change over time.
Right, but most of the other items you mentioned about the notion of normalization in the context of ontologies had to do with instance data. Is that correct?
You look at the instance data to see whether you have the right classes. And it's a way of discovering classes that are missing by looking at the instance data.
Wouldn't you want to look at the uses of your system in the first place?
You would, but you probably also ought to be looking at how it might be used, not just how it is used. One of the big problems we found in Shell was that lots of people in different parts of Shell were developing what was essentially the same system. But because they built into that implementation just particularly how they did things where they were, what they did could not be used by other people, reused in other places. So that's what the desiderata is all about, trying to get people away from.
I see
the same kinds of problems in ontologies, by the way, that very often they are designed around some really quite specific purpose, and reusing them is almost impossible. So nearly everything that we were doing in databases in the 80s and 90s applies to ontologies in the noughties and beyond.
And one of the problems in reusing ontologies is it's not clear what the assumptions may have been, i.e. people were not sufficiently explicit in explaining their choices, in which case implicit assumptions may be revealed.
Yes, and that's exactly true. And one of the things that I used to talk about a lot was about context, where what I meant by context was what it was assumed that everyone knew but wasn't written down. And that was always what tripped you up, and that one of the key things you needed to do with your ontology or your data model was make the context explicit.
Yes, and that's a very difficult process. And if we had Hans Poelzer online, he can go on ad infinitum about that problem.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, indeed.
Thanks. So I had a couple of thoughts on that, but I want to bring in Amanda, who has a comment that is also in response to this question. Amanda, do you want to expand on your point about ontology-native senses of normalization?
Oh, can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Okay, great. Sure. The second part of the comment I put in the chat is actually related to what Matthew just mentioned about context. But the first point is actually that there are senses of normalization that have been important in ontological systems for decades, prior to the semantic web versions of these. But CNF and DNF are conjunctive and disjunctive normal forms. So this is something actually that I see missing in some of the semantic web technologies and tools, but in older systems, especially with very expressive languages where you have multiple people, over great expanses of time, adding knowledge to the knowledge base, the form in which that they may express something is going to vary over time, where I would consider the same person in another mood to be a different user. So there, what you have is something under the hood that's essentially transforming all of the assertions into some logically normalized form, making that so that. That's helping both with inference efficiency and with the ability to detect duplication and dependencies and so forth. But then ontologically, I think one of the things that happens a lot with the ontology creation, by especially when the developers don't have particularly deep or varied experience with ontologies for different purposes, is that you see, exactly what Matthew mentioned, you see a lot of things being left implicit, and in particular, if people, they may be contextual things or they may just be relationships. So for example, if you had some data that, if you had course data that listed, the ID, like say student or personnel IDs of everybody taking a course, there's an implicit entity there that's the person whose ID that is. There's not really a direct relationship, right, between, say, the student or employee ID and the course instance, right? But you will see people represent this data for a service or for the web or for something like this as though that were the relationship, and they won't, materialize or bring in the person who's taking that course, whose ID that is. So one form of normalization is to try and bring in those implicit middle entities, and that increases your reusability and your stability. Somebody else has data about employees or students; it can link up with that database now in a more obvious way.
Thanks. Any comments on that, Matthew?
No, I'm reminded that normalization in nearly all these terms is a tool that is aimed at helping you to discover a better data model or ontology, but doesn't necessarily guarantee it. I mean, go back to the first slide about Jack, and that was nominally... slide 5, that was nominally a data model in a high level of normalization, but I would always say it was a dreadful data model.
Right. Yeah, one thing that occurs to me just on this same topic is that since a lot of this is to do with how things change over time, there must presumably be a dependency on the way the ontology itself creates time, and whether you mentioned a four-dimensional ontology versus a more conventional current state ontology, where we tend to leave time as a exercise for the user, and again potentially some people might use quad store to deal with time rather than some of the other things you mentioned. Is that a fair description that if you're using different treatments of time itself in different ontologies, you might not be able to reuse them in the same environment because you need to understand how that relates to these deeper issues that you're talking about?
Well, I one of the advantages I have found with four-dimensionalism is that because it has change over time built into it, it adds a level of rigor which you don't find with the 3D plus time-based ontologies. There is less choice about how you do something, and that gives you less chance that two different people will have tried to do the same thing in different incompatible ways.
Right.
So I think there are some advantages in having knowing what it is that you have to address, and having that built into the core of your ontology.
Thanks. Okay, Beth DeJulian, you had a question about sub-attributes like weight and height and so on, ending up in the seven normal form slides. Do you want to expand on that question?
Yeah.
Beth?
Well, I think I'd better pick up on that quickly. If we move to... Because I forgot to say something. If we move to slide 7... I forgot to mention that this is a very simplified model of person with units and measures.
in that I've built the weight in kilograms into the relationship name. So this is just an illustration, not how I would expect to see it modelled in a fully worked through model.
Okay, and then where would you put your attributes for your thing?
For
would this be other lozenges on?
There would be
11?
I'd actually have something which in ISO 15926 we did something quite complicated. So we recognized what we called a property value, which is really a quantity. Which is an amount of weight, and then even separate from that, we had a mapping of that onto a number scale, where the scale was related to units of measure. But there might be another mapping onto another number scale that represented the same weight. So that was just too much to put on a page.
Right, right. Okay, so that's good. But just quickly, so let's go back to your use case it would be difficult to update the birth date if you made a mistake.
Yes, if this is now looking at slide 6, the idea of normalization is that if you needed to make a change,
mm-hmm.
there would only be one place that you would need to make it. So the fact that if the date of birth was incorrect, I need to update it in 3 records, is an indication that this is not in third normal form.
Right, and so show me...
According to relational normalization.
And
so if we go on to the next slide, we have state of we have person, and you have their name, and you have their start date, which is their birth date, and that only occurs once for the
right.
person. And similarly with the weight, there would for a particular person there would be a related state. Which was the a person with a particular weight, whilst they had a particular weight. And the person whilst they had a particular height, and the person whilst they had a particular marital status.
So on slide 11, you're considering that you would delete the record and recreate it if you had a mistake with the date of birth? Update it?
No, let's say that we had made a mistake with that record, then what this is saying is that you note that it is logically deleted, and you add another record, which is the correct record.
Okay. Well, good. Thank you.
Okay, that's fine. Good questions. Any other questions?
Oh, sorry, I was muted. Hi, Tara, you're up next. And could the people mute themselves locally if they're not speaking? Thanks.
Okay, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Okay. Slide 7. I'm sorry for harping on this, but
that's okay.
I think it presents an interesting difference in certain properties, for example, like height and weight, which being physical characteristics really are continually changing.
Sure.
Whereas marital status is really something that stays the same until something happens to change it. And there's a difference between an observation of height and weight, which really represents only the point at time at which that observation was made, and some record that basically says, you know, this person was married, and you might as well consider them married until an event happens in which they change to a different marital state.
Well, I think I understand what you're saying, but I think that it's really just a matter of time scale that you're dealing with. Because if I was taking a measurement every millisecond, it would seem quite reasonable that the weight was constant until they ate, and then they ate and their weight would go up. And then over time it might slowly go down, and I would have lots of different states with their weight going up and down, assuming I was measuring it in a position to measure it. And the same with the height. Although that probably changes less. So some of this is about the perspective that you have on things, because even with weight, something like weight, the change is the result of some activity taking place, which is the same with marital status. An activity takes place and that causes a change.
Well, you know, but as you say, time scale is what matters. And so if you have all these characteristics bundled up in one state, and you say, you mentioned at what point that...
I think that's the problem. I think that's the problem, that you can't really bundle them all up in one state. You actually need a different state for each characteristic. That's the key thing about moving from slide 6 to slide 7, is that we've unbundled all these different properties and given them each their own state, and that's the essence of the normalization.
Okay, I guess it's not clear in looking at slide 7 that those are really different states, because you have
three person.
Sorry.
Okay, let me try and explain it. There is one thing missing. There's a relationship missing which says that one state is a part of another. So everything would be a state of a person, for instance. But each state, if you look at state of person at the top, the state has a start date and an end date, which can be as large or as small as you want it to be, the period. And there's no requirement for contiguity, so you might have essentially a spot measurement of someone's height, which says only that whilst we were measuring it, they had this height. And you might have a gap with no measurement at all, which doesn't mean that they don't have a height, just that you don't have a measurement that you can say that you know what it is. And the same with weight and marital status. And because each of these happens at a different time, each state will have a different start date and end date. And that's why they need to be different dates, because they're not connected to each other. So you don't measure someone's height when they get married.
So I wonder if I can chip in a little question here again. This is Mike. It sounds to me that there are two things going on here, and one is what are the facts about people, for example, and the other is what are the facts recorded in the database. And that, again,
yes.
In an ontology, we say it is the fact about a person that at any given time they have exactly one height, whereas the database will have records for each time they're recorded. Where this gets interesting is in things like the Internet of Things. So if you're doing an ontology of, you know, some process plant or something, you would have to distinguish between concepts that are measurements and the things that the measurements are giving you some updated information about. Yes, so back to your early
correct,
point, Matthew.
That's indeed, and that's what's missing here. Is part of what's missing here is that the weight and the height are really the results of measurements. They're not. So this is yes, they're the result of a measurement. So there was a measurement activity that recorded a height. And again, that's just part of the simplification I did when I was doing this model.
Thanks. Although it's quite significant for ontologies, because Yeah, oh, you can take a data model and re-put it into OWL and say, oh, here's an ontology, and what you've really got is an OWL version of your logical data model. Yeah. Nothing wrong with that, probably very useful, but the thingness of it, the commitment of what it's a model of, is of your data, not of your thing. And ultimately, you need reference ontologies of the things and some way of relating one to the other.
Absolutely. Yes, so that at one level you're saying that a person has a height, and at another level you're saying someone's made a measurement of someone's height, and that those are not the same thing.
That's right. The measurement is an ontological thing called a measurement.
And that's why we get absolutely, yes. And indeed, that's how that was handled in ISO 15096, for instance. I've just simplified things here, really, because I was just trying to make one step from the model on the previous page, not five steps.
Yeah.
And I think it's enough that you move from one entity type to five to illustrate the point that normalization has a significant impact on your data model.
Absolutely.
Which was the primary point I was trying to make.
Mm. Good. Who's up next? Taro, do you still have a question or comment? I'm going to wiggle the little hand thing. I see a little conversation going on between Todd and Amanda. I wonder if we can surface that.
Do you really want to?
Why not?
I guess I'm not familiar with the type of systems Amanda had in mind with regard to her last reply tonight to my question or my assertion. Amanda?
Sure. This is really going into, as I said, sort of pre-semantic web ubiquity. The AI tradition of ontologies and so forth, whether it be in sort of full-blown systems like psych or in particular applications of expert systems, it is normal in those systems, even in just your ontology editing tool, that whatever logical form you're seeing through your interface in storage, it's being logically normalized. So even at edit time, there's an efficient process of for detecting the relationships between things, and that extends also to the ontological, where if somebody has represented the class of all red things and somebody else has represented the property redness, if those both are being axiomatized with some level of attention, then if assertions on one, so that's just so that there's some connection, like the instances of the collection of all red things have the property of being red, that these assertions that hook up with one of those forms of representation will be carried through to the other. So,
well, that I guess that addresses the middle option that I put among the three. That there's some logical relationship that can be detected among those two representations. Because again, these logical systems are just dealing with symbolic representations and not necessarily having any use of interpretations along the way. Maybe some of them do. I'm not familiar with those.
If it's ontological and not just sort of procedurally coded, it's very hard for me. How anything could make that claim to be such a system if it did not have there's got to be a reasoning going on. It's got to be able to use the its own axioms.
Right,
now
that's
actually
symbolic.
This is absolutely, well, except for it is symbolic, but here is the difference between something like a UML model, right, and an ontological model. I mean, Matthew can probably chime in on that than I can, since I haven't. I'm not nearly as deep in the less semantically explicit modes. But the whole point of using an ontology representation language is that they ground out in the logic and set theory and so forth. So at that level, at those fundamentals, those have meaning that are not open to user interpretation, right? Right? They are machine.
What does not have meaning?
I think if I can just chip in here, this is actually quite important. There are a few things which are really known to your ontology engine, and that is things like subtype, supertype, class instance, and if you're lucky, whole part.
Those are logical axioms that you've implemented.
Yes, they have logical definition, and you can process them on a logical basis. Now, marriage is something that you can write down as a word, but the computer has no idea what that means.
Correct.
And it can process it, but it just does what you say, and it there isn't meaning. There isn't logical meaning. That's right. It's symbolic manipulation, not the meaning that you and I would immediately pick up from the use of the word.
Although if the meanings of the things your symbols are about are grounded in some way, in some external reality, then the meanings of
about information system. There is no grounding other than what you have represented.
No.
Well,
true. I'm sorry, I feel really strongly about this. I agree with Matthew with what you just said, but I disagree, Todd, with what you just said. So if you are using your tools and your system understand, if you write an ontology model in a text editor, then you're right. If you write it in a system that has inference or that is an implementation of, that's natively ontological in any way, then it at least understands what Matthew listed, and that it understands it in a fixed way that is not. This is something I've had to beat people assigned to me to supervise with very, very hard. You cannot decide that subclass and parthood are the same and use the same relationship to represent both and expect anything like the inference behavior that you might be looking for or not, because subclass is fixed in every ontological language right now. But the other thing I want to say is that I think what Matthew's point really gets to is that it's absolutely true that these points about good and careful modeling and making things explicit and so forth apply as much to ontological modeling as to relational data modeling. And that if somebody doesn't axiomatize marriage, yes, it's just a bunch of symbols. And this is something that we see a lot in particularly, Allen's semantic web ontologies, more so than the older systems. We see this very superficial modeling where there's nothing, and even by people who did the other kind too, right? There's really very little axiomatization, and we get only those, relations are added but not defined.
Amanda?
Yep.
I think our point of disagreement is you mentioned earlier on the term understand in the context of machines. And I don't know if we want to belabor that point here. Are you coming to STIDS this year?
Oh, yes.
Okay, well, we'll talk about it then. But my position is that the machines are these computers that we have today are dealing with symbols that are represented electronically, and they do all sorts of cool things with them. They don't know anything about the semantics of those symbols other than what has been represented logically. And as the point about modeling is obviously then critical, because if you haven't modeled something, the machine doesn't know diddly about it.
Right, other than the primitives of the language.
The primitives of the language are still just symbols.
Not if you're working in an ontological system.
There's two things going on here. The primitives of the language are consistently grounded in logic and can't be misinterpreted in terms of the logical relationships among the symbols. The other point I was trying to make earlier that I didn't really express very well is, separately to that, and this is more contentious, is yes, the machine doesn't understand anything. I don't think anyone would disagree with that. It only manipulates symbols. But if outside of the machine we have clearly grounded a few simple primitive symbols and said this is what we outside the machine know that it means, then the results of any symbol manipulation should be similarly meaningful to us.
Well, and that's the model theory.
Exactly. Thank you.
So the model theory is a way that the symbols inside the machine relate to the real world outside.
Mm.
And there may be more than one of those is one of the challenges sometimes. Sometimes what you're trying to do is minimize the number of models that are valid.
Mm, yeah. And again, not every ontology is going to have been sliced the same way and be easily reusable to something else.
Let me just throw another challenge in. I have a conjecture, and that is that it is possible to create ontologies that only use subtype, supertype, classification, and various types of whole-part relationship. And those are the only relationship types that you need.
Ooh.
And that, in the light of what Amanda has just been saying, that would be quite interesting. It means that lots of things get wrapped up into the classes that you have, so that you need to have ways of defining your classes and what it is to be of a particular class. So, but it does, I think, say something about a level of rigor that you can. This ought to be possible. It's a conjecture. I can't prove that, but I think it's possible.
Mm. Amanda, your hand's up. Is that a response to Matthew's conjecture?
It is.
Great.
Actually, I think that OWL goes, you know, sort of, at least I'll say that, you know, OWL is an interesting case in that it actually goes, well, it doesn't exactly line up with what Matthew was saying, but it's sort of the primitives are fairly restricted, and many people don't model with much beyond that. They could, and they could model much more than they typically do, just given those tools. But more generally, I think what I want to say to Matthew is I think that's probably correct. But it's good to know. It's good to know that you can transform very complex representations into sort of very few primitives. But it's analogous to, you know, for anybody who's studied, you know, had an intro to logic class, right? Then you know that you don't need all of the symbols, right? You don't need and or not, you know, implies and, you know, and bidirectional implication. But we almost always work with at least those five. And the reason why we do, it's good to know that you can transform an implies statement to something with just nots and ors. But you don't want to do that every day, right? You don't want to be in your actual modeling, right, if you make the language simpler, you make the modeling more complex.
I wouldn't say that you make the modeling more complex. I think it's more that it would be more complicated.
Yeah, okay.
I think it makes the modeling simpler because it becomes more regular. And therefore easier to check. And so when you're doing this moderation between different models, it becomes useful to be able to do this in a model that is reduced in some sense to something that is very rigorous. And you're really breaking things down into the smallest pieces that they can be. And you know that you can't go any further in terms of breaking things down. That doesn't mean you have to always break them down to that level.
Mm-hmm.
The conjecture is that that you can, not necessarily that you should.
Hmm. there's something people might be interested in. Last week at ISWIC, a couple of people, including Bijan Parsia and Jim Hendler, were saying that a future direction that OWL could take would be to add things like whole-part relations and even things like quantities and units of measure and so on. Now, I'll admit that makes me nervous because I think, well, surely different ontologists will have wanted to create different ways of representing that. But on the other hand, for what we're talking about now, if more of that is in the language, is that helpful? What do people think?
Well, the challenge with units, quantities and units of measure is that there isn't really agreement about what they really are. Exactly. If you read the standards on quantities, what you find is that there is ambiguity very carefully built into the standard to cover the differences of opinion.
There is. What we did in FIBO was we looked at the ontologies that are used for units of measure, and they are very much facing to the side of what the data might look like. And then we look back at the more scientific standards about what measurement is and introduce an ontological representation of the act of measurement. And that enabled us to dispose all of the data-facing ontological concepts into a more coherent framework, which wasn't otherwise there.
And it's even worse than that, because when you start looking at dimensionality, it turns out that the way that that's been approached in measurement, in the measurement world, is one of making the calculations simpler rather than in terms of real ontological understanding, because it's all about being able to cancel out. Dimensional analysis is all about not having to do conversions between units. And actually, the dimensionality is really there. So these dimensionless ratios that you have really have a dimensionality of what it is that was cancelled out before. And you need to, I think in ontological terms, you need to have that understanding of dimensionality rather than the cancelling out units of measure, which is what is convenient for doing sums. So, yeah.
Good point. And of course, it doesn't help that one of those dimensions is time, which brings us back to where we were.
Sure.
Any other comments, questions?
What are you up to? Want me to call you?
Oh, somebody's not muted themselves. I'm too fine.
Okay.
That's another interesting point that came out of this. We mentioned bitemporality briefly earlier, but we've sort of covered that in a way. The difference between what the data believes and what the things are is really what bitemporality is about, is having two sets of temporal measures, one saying
one for when it happened and one for when the record was.
That's it, yeah.
And that's,
got it.
that's essentially covered in slide eight. Is where
slide
the record
eight,
is.
Right.
And then slide seven has the date and time for the things.
Good going. Oh, yeah, and look at the coat, the jacket.
Yeah, and somebody is on another phone, and I don't know how to mute people individually. I don't think it can necessarily be done.
I think it's Amanda.
time to stop.
I think we've run out of questions, haven't we? It's been a very, very useful conversation. Is there anything anybody else is... burning to mention, or anything in the chat anybody would like to expand upon?
I did not know her well. I knew who she was. Yeah.
Okay. Well, thank you, everyone, and thank you, Matthew, for a very enlightening and interesting presentation. It's pulled up a lot of fascinating ontological issues. Reminds me slightly of a thing I was at last week, where I was in a room with some of the real sort of serious philosophical ontologists, and, you know, trying to answer these kind of questions, it's a lot of really deep issues here that worth reflecting on. So thank you very much for bringing all that up. We'll meet again in 2 weeks' time when chaps called Mike Bennett of EDM Council and Hypercube will be presenting on the EDM Council FIBO work on extending current things and some of the stuff we've done there. So join us again in 2 weeks' time at the same time. And thank you all very much for participating. It's been a great lot of interaction. So thank you all very much, and goodbye.
To the left of the driveway as you're driving in. Yeah.